a difference in general
of tongue and dream. There's a mystery, there's an awesomeness about the archetypal dream that is not present really in at the level of the personal dream or the symbols that come from what Jung would call that layer called the personal unconscious. But what comes from what he calls the collective unconscious, and what he means by that is the unconscious level that we all share in common, that has a much deeper and more pervasive and awesome emotional tone to it. You get that sense of participating in the human drama. Not just your own individual isolated story, but in a sense, everybody's story. So, some of the types of symbols that function as archetypal symbols would be nature symbols, fire, water, wind. Symbols taken from nature that affect all of us in some way, in the same kind of way. And animal symbols. Helpful animals, threatening animals. Both of them symbolizing the lower levels of our instinct. Either helping us or threatening us. Familial symbols, mother, father, child symbols. Child being new birth, new psychic birth. Symbols of kingship, rulership, symbolizing the self. Heroism, the wise old man and the wise old woman. Archetypal symbols. See, now a person from your own life may enter into a dream and be the carrier of the symbolic meaning of the wise old man or of the wise old woman. There may be someone in your life who carries that symbolic meaning. And the psyche need go no further to find someone to carry that symbolic meaning. Now, a point that I didn't mention or emphasize in the last class, but I think it's important, is that archetypal dreams occur with relative frequency when a person is negotiating the major passages of natural human development. The natural development of the human life, from childhood into adolescence through puberty, for instance. It's part of the unfolding of nature. And at that moment, the archetypal dreams are liable to occur with greater frequency. Because you are going through one of the phases of the human story that you share in common with all other human beings. Or the midlife passage. Jung's psychology, I think, is particularly geared, oriented towards enabling people to negotiate the passage from the first half of life to the second half of life. And there's a major psychic transition that takes place there. The decentering of the ego and the allowing the psychic center of your being to sink to a deeper level, as Jung calls the self. And there will be archetypal dreams occurring with greater frequency as you're going through that natural passage of life that is part of the universal human drama, or the approach of death, whether it be in old age or at any other point in a person's life. The archetypal dreams will occur more frequently because you're engaged in the universal human story at that point. Or a woman, a pregnant woman about to give birth to a child, participating again in the natural unfolding of the human drama that we all are part of in some way. Also in children's dreams, archetypal symbols are relatively frequent because the child is closer to the universal rhythms of nature. The individual ego has not yet emerged in the child. There's not much of a personal unconscious yet. The child is closer to the universal human. And the individuation has not begun to take place in the child. Well, it has begun, but it hasn't proceeded very far. And so there's not much of a personal unconscious that's been personally left out. The unconscious is collective. universal child. Also, I believe, and that this is something that I want to explore, but it's, I've put it forward as a hypothesis, I think that that archetypal dreams occur with relative frequency in periods of history when cultures are undergoing mammoth shifts, major transitions in cultural orientation. The great Greek myths, this is my hypothesis, and I think it can be borne out. It's an interpretation. But the great myths of Greek culture are symbolic expressions of the axial shift that was taking place in human interiority in ancient Greece between the years of 800 and 200 BC. Any of you are probably familiar with Karl Jasper's thesis. Between those, in that 600-year period, a major movement took place away from myth and to realism. Scientific, philosophical, and common sense realism as the basis for controlling meaning. There is an emergence of intellectual and rational capacities as habitual guides in human life that took place during that period. And I believe that some of the major Greek myths are reflective of that. The myth of Prometheus, stealing the fire from the gods and having to suffer the punishment that goes along with that. What is the fire? It's the fire of intelligence. It's the fire of autonomy, the autonomy of the individual intelligence. Stealing that away from the gods of myth, but having to suffer the punishment that goes with that. And it was an extremely painful period, breaking away. And to give an archetypal interpretation of the Oedipal myth, where there is the emergence of individual autonomy frustrated. It goes astray in the myth of Oedipus, whereas in the myth of Orestes, it finally is resolved. Orestes, who slayed the mother, the representative of the old order, is pursued by the Furies and has to suffer for doing that, but is finally vindicated by a woman who represents the new order, Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And she casts the deciding vote in his favor, that what he did in slaying the old order is vindicated. Established the new civic order. I think a lot of the great Greek myths are reflective of that fantastic drama that went on at that point. And today is another period, I'm convinced, of axial shift. I'm not going to get into that, but I think that there is an axial shift that is going on in our time, and I don't think it's accidental or arbitrary that Jung stumbles upon collective symbols at this point in history. Called and challenged to a new axial shift, the world cultural shift in cultural orientation. Then in the last class, I also indicated that there is a further level of symbolic imagery, which I call the anagogic. Anagogic dreams reflect not so much my development as a part of nature, but my engagement in a drama that goes beyond the whole realm of nature. I am oriented beyond the cosmos by my very being. And it is that orientation sets up a major conflict, and that's the conflict of good and evil. And my orientation beyond the cosmos to God is expressed in dreams that reveal the numinous and the holy. That reveal the holy as what I am geared towards, oriented towards, or that reveal the holy as entering into my life to call me or to free me from the grip of evil or to challenge me. There are enough indications of dreams that I would call anagogic to make that a separate category in dream symbolism, a distinct category. I gave you one example of what I would call anagogic dreams in the last class, my friend's healing dream, the healing of the persona, of the face that he set to the outside world. Other examples of what I would consider to be anagogic. In Jung's autobiography, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, pages 217 to 221, in that autobiography, there is a dream, and it begins with Jung's father, who had been a Protestant clergyman, Calvinist clergyman, reformed clergyman. Jung's father preaching an eloquent sermon on the early chapters of Genesis, on the creation of the world by God. And Jung said that we were awestruck by the eloquence with which he commented on the early chapters of Genesis. Something, by the way, that Jung never was in his lifetime. He was never awestruck by his father's religious expression. In fact, he was repelled by it. He was turned off by it. But at any rate, in this dream, his father is doing something that Jung never experienced in his own lifetime, namely preaching eloquently and with tremendous participation in the mystery that he was preaching about. He's wrapped up in it. And then his father leads him into a mandala-shaped temple. Mandala-shaped room. Mandala being Jung's symbol for natural wholeness, the perfectly round room with the throne of the king in the middle, where the king would sit. And up on the wall, there was a balcony all the way around the room where the king's counselors and philosophers would sit. And the king would give his orders to the counselors and philosophers and receive their advice. It's a perfect symbol for what Jung called the self. Centered self, with the self in the center and receiving from the various complexes and giving orders to the various complexes around the self. That's a perfect symbol for that. His father leads him into that, and once they get into the room, his father then says to him, "And now I will lead you into the highest presence." Points to a spot on the wall where there's an opening beyond the mandala-shaped room, beyond the self, to the other world, to the world that lies beyond the natural wholeness, the wholeness of nature. And the guardian of that gateway is Uriah the Hittite, the story of David and Bathsheba. It's the mystery of innocent suffering. And Jung says, "I knew in the dream that Uriah the Hittite was a prefigurement of the Christ, and therefore a prefigurement of redemptive suffering." And at that point, Jung's father kneels down on the floor and bows his head to the floor in profoundest adoration, touching his forehead to the floor. And Jung says, "I imitated him, but I could not bring my forehead to the floor. It was a millimeter to spare. Could not do it. I was not able. And I would not do it." And then he defends that option. "I will not be a mere fish," he says. "A dumb fish. I will not submit. I will not adore that kind of God whom I reach through the mystery of redemptive suffering." And I prefer the enclosed self. I'm giving you my interpretation. I prefer the enclosed self to the mystery of redemptive suffering that leads beyond the self into the mystery of the God. I prefer the enclosed self. And shortly after that, he writes Answer to Job, which is a vindication of his preference, of his option. All right, now I would regard that as anagogic. I would regard the dream as an indication of where he is at in response to and in participation in the redemptive mystery. And in that sense, it's expressing something about his orientation beyond nature and beyond the cosmos. Another indication of this. Now, again, you see, this is precarious stuff. My whole worldview is determining and conditioning my interpretation of the dream. My interpretation is different. Because we basically have different philosophical and theological starting points. It's precarious when you get into this sort of thing. A man by the name of Schurhammer has written a 2-volume biography of St. Francis Xavier. And in Schurhammer's book, when Francis Xavier first meets Ignatius Loyola in Paris, he's having dreams about being in India, something that was going to take place a long ways hence, you see. A long ways after that, a long time after that. And he's going around telling his fellow companions with Ignatius, I'm having these dreams about going to India. What in the world is that all about? I've never thought about it. Well, the spark of his own vocation is being introduced into his psyche at that point. The orientation and the direction that he's being led is starting, beginning to be communicated. Scriptural accounts of visions and dreams. Rudolf Bultmann would want to reduce most of them to myth. I don't. The scriptural accounts of visions and dreams are imagery that symbolize that orientation to the divine and the entrance of the divine into human history. Or that symbolize that are indications of people's calls, of guidance being given by God. They carry out their call. And scriptural imagery in general, eschatological and apocalyptic imagery, is all anagogic. It doesn't just imitate nature, but indicates the transformation of nature. The archetypal symbols imitate nature. A helpful maternal symbol bringing nourishment is an imitation of the mother in her nourishing capacities. And it indicates psychic nourishment on its way. The symbol is used to imitate what nature does. But the anagogic symbol points to the total transformation of nature in the kingdom of God, as it appears in Scripture. Anagogic imagery, as it appears in Scripture, points to the transformation of nature by grace. By the eschatological act of God, the lion shall lie down with the lamb. That is not an imitation of nature. That is a transformation of nature. That doesn't happen in nature. Once it does, we're into the kingdom of God. It's not an imitation of nature to symbolize something natural in the development of the human psyche. It points to the total transformation of nature under the eschatological power of God's guidance of human history. The heavenly Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, a city where there are no more tears, and no more mourning, and no more pain, and no more crying. That is not an imitation of nature. That is the total transformation of nature, pointing to the eschatological hope of the earth. So that's the kind of thing. I think that there's enough evidence to make that a distinct category from archetype and the anagogy. All right, that's a little bit of a review plus giving you some more examples of what I mean by anagogic symbols. Are there any questions on that material? Okay, and negotiating dreams. I have basically 3 points here. And some of these are I've indicated in passing before, but I just want to put them into a systematic framework. The dream is to be negotiated first by being taken up into the order of human intentional consciousness. The levels of consciousness that we talked about when we spoke of the creative vector. The whole point of psychic conversion is to establish the connection between consciousness and the unconscious. That connection is established by taking the dream which emerges out of the unconscious up into consciousness through the levels of our human intentional consciousness. So the first thing about negotiating dreams is that you work them through the grid of human consciousness. You bring them into empirical consciousness through memory, by remembering them. You bring them through the processes of intelligent consciousness by interpreting the dream. What does it mean? You bring them through the processes of rational consciousness by interpreting the dream as accurately as you can. Am I accounting for each element in the dream? Particularly for all of the affective resonances that I felt when I experienced the dream. Keep moving. As long as there are any further questions, you keep asking. And then you bring them through the operations of existential consciousness. So here's where the real crux of the thing comes. By asking questions, all right, what am I going to do with this self-knowledge that I've gained? What am I going to do about it? What difference is it going to make? Now, why is that one so important? Because it's only by following through on those questions that a transformation begins to take place at the unconscious level. Otherwise, you keep dreaming the same thing, themes, over and over and over again. Now, a lot of the material that's been presented on dream interpretation, or dream negotiation, does not disengage the significance of this level, of dealing with the dreams also at the existential level. It stops with interpretation. It's not enough. And in fact, people do more than simply interpret. They do change their lives, change their behavior on the basis of their interpretation. And it's that change in behavior that works the transformation at the unconscious level. There are feelings that you have as you dream about your own behavior. You notice patterns in yourself, you see, and you have a certain feeling that goes along with that pattern, and you ask yourself the question, do I want that? Do I want that feeling? Do I want that pattern? Or do I want something else? And if the answer is I want a different pattern, and then you start attempting to introduce a different pattern into your behavior, that's when you begin to notice that the dreams start reflecting new patterns. The transformation is beginning to occur. Dream indicates that you've got a pattern of always behaving under certain circumstances in a certain way. You run away from them. And over again, you're having dreams of running away from conflict. And you feel like you're chickening out as you do that, right in the dream. And then you raise the question, do I want to keep living my life that way? Do I want to keep running away from conflict? Do I want to keep chickening out or not? And if you say no, then you begin slowly to start staying with conflict and negotiating it in a new way, and you find that slowly your dreams begin to reflect new patterns. Transformation begins to take place. Otherwise, there's no sense. Why establish the connection between consciousness and the unconscious if all it's going to show you is your own misery? Why not? Who wants that? But if it's going to lead to a shift in your own behavior that eventually perhaps begins to relieve some of that misery, well, then there's this point to psychic conversion. Otherwise, let's forget about it. Life is miserable enough without any emotion. Them up, not going down. Don't negotiate dreams by going down into the unconscious. That's a mess. It's not ordered.
I had a dream in Zurich, some of you know this already, while I was writing the dissertation, that gave me it was the image that I needed for the insight, that tied the whole dissertation together. Up until that point, I was doing nothing but writing introductions. About 30 introductions. But until this came along, it was that the key was not there. In the dream, I'm going down a set of flight of stairs in a building that has several stories. And I'm just about to the first story of the building, the first floor, the ground floor, not the basement, the ground floor of the building. Just about 3 steps above the ground floor of the building, going down, and I meet Bernard Lonergan. He's coming up the stairs. This is in those articles that are religious, so you may run into it there. He's going up the creative vector, you see, up the ladder. I'm going down. And he says to me, he stops and he looks at me very intently, right in the eye. He says, "If you really want to see some images, come with me." Very authoritative. He takes me up to the top floor of the building. It was very clear that it was the top floor, 4th level of consciousness. So we go into a large room and sit down next to one another, and a movie begins to appear on the screen in front of the room. And we begin then to negotiate the images with the kind of aesthetic distance that enables us to be intelligent, rational, and responsible in negotiating them and not getting caught in them. And the whole point of the dream was, don't get stuck down here in the basement. See? You don't have the distance to be intelligent, rational, and responsible in dealing with the images. You just get swamped by them down there. There's all kinds of creatures down there, you see. And you'll be overwhelmed if you deal with them down there. You've got to bring them up. And at that point, the thesis fell in place. The crucial importance, then, of using the capacities of consciousness that we have to deal with our dreams. And so I think that for psychology in general, there's a crucial importance to understanding those higher levels of consciousness. The kind of thing that Lonergan has done is very important for reorientating the science of psychology, that disengagement of those higher levels of consciousness. A very important thing for writing psychology. It better be important, otherwise everything I'm doing is worthless. But there's some things, you know, that you can start to stake an awful lot on, and this is one that I would stake an awful lot on. In terms of devoting your energies to it, that to put together an adequate depth psychology depends upon an understanding of those higher levels of consciousness into which you raise the dimensions that emerge from the unconscious, out of the unconscious. Secondly, in terms of negotiating, and I've said this before, let the interpretation of the dream come by continuing to want the meaning of the dream, raising the question, but do not force the meaning. Don't adopt a conceptualistic approach, dumping categories onto symbols. Such and such a symbol always has this meaning, and therefore, no. Let the interpretation come. Just as you let any insight that you want come in the course of pursuing it. You cannot force insight. You have to wait for it. John Donne has a paper in somewhere, and I'm not sure where it is, but it's called Waiting for Insight. And the point that he's making has as much bearing on the meaning of our dreams as it does on anything else. We need to keep alert and awake and questioning, but we have to wait for the insight to come. And finally, and this I've said before too, don't go after more than manifests itself spontaneously. The healing process is gradual. It goes over time. And the condition for the next step of healing is cooperating with the stuff that's being offered to you now. So deal with that. Don't try to resolve all 42 years of your history in one interpretation of one dream. Again, that's forcing the meaning. Take what's being given. That's enough for the next step of the journey. Okay. Any questions on that? The next part then, number 4, dreams and the original experience. I want to expand upon what we've already said here and to introduce some new notions that are going to be important as we move into later aspects of our material. I think that all psychologies that I've run into anyway, and I would presume that this would be the case with any psychology, in fact, any human science, will have an explicit or implicit assumption as to what constitutes the ground meaning, the basic meaning, the core of meaning in human experience. Existential psychologies, for instance, build off of Martin Heidegger's book, Being in Time, Sein und Zeit, where Heidegger spends pages, the whole volume, trying to disengage the core meaning of all human experience. He basically does, you know, a quite thorough job. I'm not in thorough agreement with him, but it's a lot better than a lot of other things that I've seen. And then you have whole psychologies that take that as their basic assumption and interpret all psychological experience, affective experience, dream experience, symbolic experience, and so on, in the light of that basic assumption as to the core and ground meaning of all human experience. In Freudian psychology, and most of Freud up until at least 1920, the core meaning of all experience has to do with what Freud calls the cathexis of libido, the attachments. What our sexual energy attaches itself to and goes after. And our desire is fundamentally and irreducibly sexual, and everything that we pursue is some kind of displacement of that sexual libido. And so that desire and its displacements are the core meaning of all human experience. Up until at least 1920, where he introduces, at that point, the moving beyond the pleasure principle and deals with the problem of death and the confrontation with death. And at that point, he begins to converge, incidentally, on Heidegger and the existential thought. And Ernest Becker, in The Denial of Death, has taken up that connection of Freudian and existential thought, and Becker has said, no, the basic ground meaning of all human experience is the terror of death and what we do to repress that. That's the original experience that informs all the manifestations and disguises that display themselves as we live out our lives. Now, when I'm using the term here, original experience, I don't mean first in time. But I mean at the origin of all experience, at the origin of all experience, or aboriginal if you want. Now, I am trying to develop a psychology that contains an assumption regarding the meaning of all human experience. And for me, the core of it is, I adopt the phrase from Eric Vogel, and it is the search for direction in the movement of life. The search for direction in the movement of life as the core or original experience, in the sense of being at the origin of all of our human experience. Our experience differs from that of lower animals precisely because we don't find our place in being just by automatic stimulus response mechanism. It would be so easy if we could, but we don't. And in
fact, Kierkegaard spends half of either or, his book Either Or, showing that anyone who chooses to live that way, chooses to find his place, his or her place in being, simply by the automatic stimulus response mechanisms of the lower animal, is heading for despair. The aesthetic pattern of experience, of existence. We cannot find our place in being in that way. Direction for the human animal is much more complex because the human psyche is not tied so exclusively to the needs and goals of the body. The animal psyche is tied up with, completely tied up, with the needs and goals of the organism, and is a means towards the satisfaction of those goals. The psyche, the animal's consciousness, is an instrument that the animal uses in satisfying the goals of the organism, including the goal of play. It's not just, there's an aesthetic liberation in animal consciousness. It reveals itself in animal play. It's not just food, drink, sex, and so on and so forth, sleep, but also play. We find ourselves, as I said, and as Kierkegaard says, in a condition of existential despair if we limit our psyches too much to purely bodily meanings. We have to search and find direction, and we do that by using the higher levels of our consciousness, by seeking meaning, by affirming rationally grasped evidence, and by deciding what our course of action will be. That's the way we find direction. So, and I would say that this, what I'm calling the original experience, at the origin of all human experience, can be said to inform even the experience of an infant, in this sense, that the infant's experience, how do I judge whether a person's infancy has been healthy or unhealthy? Well, has it contributed to and freed the person for the human search for direction in life, and enabled and facilitated that, or has it so overwhelmed the person that it has rendered that search more difficult, futile, frustrating? So that's the basis on which I would want to judge the healthiness or the unhealthiness of a person's infancy. Okay. Now, what I want to focus on here is the relationship between that, because I've talked about that core meaning before. How does that tie into what we've just been talking about in terms of dreams and the psyche and the levels of consciousness? And this is 4A here on sensitivity and creativity. I'll just do 4A and then we'll break for 10 minutes. The movement of life is experienced in the sensitive flow of our psychic and aesthetic experience. That's where we experience the movement of life. That sensitive psychic flow, affective, aesthetic experience. And the direction is found in that movement of life by performing the operations of attentive, intelligent, rational, morally responsible, loving. Core experience is the search for direction in the movement of life. The movement is experienced affectively, psychically, aesthetically, sensitively, and the direction is found by being attentive, intelligent, rational, responsible, and loving in that movement, the direction in that movement. The operations, as we've said before, are permeated by the flow of psychic experience, by the movement of life. The operations are permeated and they change. The movement of life changes as we perform different operations. Now, in attempting to write a psychology that is an alternative to some of those that we are finding, that are available to us now, one of the things that I have tried to do in more recent stuff is to take Freud's notion, Freud's category of primary process, and to use that term in a different way from the way Freud uses it. I would refer to the search for direction in the movement of life, the complex of psychic and intentional constituents that I just talked about, as the primary process of human existence. The search for direction in the movement of life is the primary, is primary process. I'm trying to take a Freudian term and say that Freud is reducing that, is narrowing that notion of primary process too much. The primary process is the pulsing flow of life in which insights and judgments and decisions and acts of love occur. And secondary process, Freudian term, is capturing primary process through self-knowledge, through self-appropriation, appropriating the primary process, doing the kinds of things we're doing in this course. Secondary process. There's also primary process involved in secondary process. We're attempting to articulate primary process, reflecting back upon it and grasping its intelligibility. So primary process, original experience, and if some of you are reading Subject and Psyche, I use a term in the second chapter there, primordial immediacy. They all mean the same thing. They all refer to that complex, I don't want to use the word complex, in a different way, that psychic intentional constellation of the movement of life in which we find direction by performing the operations of human intentionality. I use those terms that way, and it's the basis of the alternative approach to psychology that I'm slowly working out. And of course the healing vector comes in there too. It's not just the moving primary process moving from above, below, upwards, but primary process moving and also through the healing vector as healing touches the psyche and affects and changes the psychic movement of life and frees a person to perform the intentional operations by which the person will find direction and movement of life. All right, I'll pick up from there after I'll tell you that thing.